This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University. Today's date is the 3rd of February, 2004, and I'm beginning an oral history interview with Lieutenant Colonel Frank Vavrick of the United States Army. I am in the Special Collections Building interview room on the campus of Texas Tech, and Colonel Vavrick is at his home in Orange Park, Florida. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. Sir, I wonder if we could begin by just discussing a little bit about your early background and some biographical data. First of all, where were you born and when, sir?
Well, I was born in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. in 1943.
Okay.
And actually grew up, though, in a little town called Nemacolin. It's a coal mining town.
Uh-huh. How far is that from Harrisburg?
Maybe 100 miles. It's right on the western edge of Pennsylvania, West Virginia.
Is it a safe assumption that your father was connected with the mining industry?
Oh, yeah. He was a coal miner, mm-hmm. worked coal mines, steel mills, that all his life, basically.
Okay. And was he a Pennsylvania native?
Yeah, he was. Uh-huh. Yeah. My grandfather was an immigrant from, I believe it was Austria.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about your mother. What was her maiden name, and where was she from?
Well, my mother died when I was born of childbirth.
Complications
of childbirth. So okay. I didn't really know her.
No, not at all. Uh-huh.
So I was raised on the farm mainly by my aunts and uncles.
Uh-huh. Would that be on your dad's side?
On my dad's side, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He brought me there. Then my dad, well, I got my dog barking.
That's okay.
Yeah. And when I was, about 5 years old, my dad remarried
mm-hmm.
to a local girl, my stepmom,
mm-hmm.
my mother, Donna Vavrick.
And what was her maiden name?
Dugan. Her maiden name was Dugan, yeah.
Okay, D-U-G-A-N?
D-U-G-A-N, yeah.
Okay, uh-huh. And did your parents go to have much schooling?
No, neither one really completed high school.
Okay.
Mainly completed grade school, then went to work, whatever work they could find. Of course, my mother, I don't think, ever worked. When I say my mother now, that's my stepmother.
Sure, uh-huh.
Never worked at all.
How many kids were there in your entire family?
Four in our family.
Uh-huh.
Here was me, then, my two stepbrothers and my stepsister.
Okay. And how far away from you in age are your stepbrothers?
Let's see. There's about 7-8 years difference between.
So you were the oldest one of the pack.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I came into the marriage.
Yeah, right. That's right. You were part of the goods that came
yeah,
with it came
yeah.
with your dad.
Yeah.
And so you were just about what? Did you say four or so?
Let's see. Five? I think it was five.
Okay. Do you remember that? Do you remember?
Vague memories. Uh-huh. I know it was a difficult time.
Sure.
As a child, you introduced a new stranger and all, so there was some difficulty I can
sure.
recall between my stepmother and I in our early years.
And
mainly it was, my doings because I was probably more rebellious. Because, I was taken away from out of my aunt's
uh-huh.
homes where I guess I was pretty well spoiled from what I can gather.
I could see that, yeah.
Yeah.
And that kind of disturbance is always a little, unsettling for everybody.
So, and it was a new environment. So, yeah, we struggled there.
Mm-hmm. Growing up, did you favor school, or were you involved in sports?
Yeah, I did well academically.
Okay.
As in high school, I made honor roll each time. I was involved in track and football primarily. I played a little basketball, but I wasn't really good at basketball.
Uh-huh.
But I did all right in track. That was probably my best athletic events.
What did you run in track?
I ran a mile, half mile,
uh-huh.
pole vaulted. Those are the three things I did pretty well.
Now, what high school did
you... It was Carmichael's. It was then Carmichael's, or Cumberland Township High School. It's
uh-huh.
now Carmichael's Area High School.
Okay. So would it be safe to say that it's a rural high school with kids coming from a broad area?
Yeah, pretty wide area around there, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think our graduating class was probably 90-some students.
Mm-hmm. You said you played football. What positions did you play?
And
uh-huh. On the defense or?
Both sides,
okay.
Offense, defense. Got
mm-hmm.
to catch a few passes.
Okay. And did you like best? Did you think football was really your home or was it track?
No, I think track was more mine for
uh-huh.
size and stature, and I had more stamina.
What about?
I was kind of light and thin. I wasn't real heavy.
Uh-huh. Were there any coaches that were particularly significant for you?
Well, Coach Duvak, he's a hardcore guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Can you tell us a little bit about him?
He's just a big, burly guy that I can remember, and the assistant coaches, too. There was another one called Lapowitz, was his last name. These guys rode us, tried to keep us on a straight track, you know.
Uh-huh, right.
When we smoked cigarettes and all, they told, you know, they'd pull us aside and tell us, you know, it's not good for us and all that, and kind of led us and guided us, and not just in sports, but, you know, physically and morally, they give us,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of jerk a knot in our ear every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, how did your parents support you, or how did they feel about your academic work and the fact that you're doing
well? They were proud of that. We weren't a rich family, like I said, working in the coal mines back then, you know.
Sure.
And there were times my dad was unemployed,
mm-hmm.
because there were strikes in the coal mines, and we were just making it, living on the farm. Of course, we had the farm, so, you know, it seemed like there was always food.
Okay.
I don't remember any uh-huh. periods where we were devastated, hungry, or lacking for any kind of clothes, because, you know, it was always well taken care of.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, did you work on the farm as well?
Yeah, sure. I worked, well, you know, my dad daily chores, getting up, feeding water the cows, the chickens, milking the cows. Those were all standard chores, getting up early in the morning,
mm-hmm.
doing that kind of stuff. And also in the summer, when not in school, I would work on another adjoining farm and earn, you know, some spending money.
Mm-hmm.
Not much, but go down and help them bale hay and, you know, harvest corn and all that stuff in the fall.
You mentioned that there were occasionally strikes at the mine.
Uh-huh.
Did your dad have any kind of position on, for example, unions?
No,
or
he was
any
not
of that?
A union. He was
uh-huh.
just a worker.
Uh-huh.
One of the workers, and he was a member, union member. And, yeah, when they, you know, they called strikes and all, I mean, they just flat stopped working.
And that was tough.
And that was tough. And then in later years, like through high school and that, the mine shut down. I mean, they laid off people because, you know, the work and the coal kind of just stopped. That town's, like, dried up now. There's no coal at all coming out of that town now.
Mm-hmm. And what about, have you been back there recently?
Oh, yeah. I've uh-huh. been back up there just this past summer.
Really?
You know, just back. My mother still is living there. She's living there by herself. My uh-huh. father's died.
Uh-huh.
And I went up. My brother, he has a farm with his wife, and they manage some gardens. So we went up there in late summer, harvested some tomatoes and green beans, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
helped them, spent a week up there with them, and, you know, it was enjoyable.
What was it like going back up there? Have you visited often, or was
that... We try to visit once a year at least. It doesn't always succeed, but... Yeah, we love to go back because my roots were there. I grew up there. It's my home ground, the hills, the people,
mm-hmm.
my family, you know, is there. Most of my family is there. My sister and I are the only two that really, you know, left the area in pursuit of careers, different careers. But, you know, the rest of them, my brothers, both my remaining brothers stay there. Most of my cousins are there. They just grew up there, and they mm-hmm. kind of, their roots go in, and they just won't go, you know.
Yeah, I have the same
they
thing.
They can't. I mean, if they... No work. They sit there. I don't care if they starve to death. They're not going to go out of there, you know?
That's right.
That's
I have the same thing up in Michigan, so I know what you're talking about.
That's kind of home.
Yeah. As far as your own thinking about your career when you were in high school,
uh-huh.
were you thinking that you would follow your dad and work in the mine? Or?
No, I always aspired to go beyond that. I mean, that was most of the guys' dreams was either, you know, graduate from high school, get a job in a coal mine, get a job in a steel mill,
mm-hmm.
you know, and those were, that was solid work, it was good income, it was steady, you know, that was mostly the mindset.
Exactly.
And I said I was more adventurous, I wanted to reach out beyond that, you know, and I didn't have any clear grasp of what I wanted to do, but I just didn't want to stay there, you know, and get up every day and go to the mine, do your job, come home, you know.
Where do you think that spark such that you wanted something other than the safe route came
from? Through education, reading, mm-hmm. things I read, books. I love, you know, in school, teachers inspiring me. as a student, let me see, my senior year, I won an essay contest.
Tell us about that.
What freedom means to me, or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but
uh-huh.
as a result, that was, you know, I was the area, I won the area championship, which also won me a scholarship to in-state university, you know, Penn State or University of Pennsylvania or University of Pittsburgh.
Wow.
With all academic scholarship.
Right.
Okay, and but I never used it, and mainly because when I applied and everything, I had applied to Penn State, and they sent me a form back, said, fine, you know, you're accepted, and I needed to come up with the admission fee and everything, and the scholarship didn't cover that. And of course, when I asked my dad, it was like, I can't remember, $100 or $200.
Uh-huh.
And my dad's philosophy was, hey, college is not what you need. You need to get your job, in, you know,
uh-huh.
and go to work and start earning money and get yourself established, you know. And, you know, the main thing then, too, there was the draft. So in order to get, before you could get a job, you had to put in your 2 years.
Right.
But most employers, and you know, when you went to apply for any kind of real job, like with the coal mines or with the steel mills, there were two things you had to do. One, they asked, you know, where's your discharge papers?
Mm-hmm.
And number two, are you a member of the union? So if you met those two things, then they would talk to you and hire you. Otherwise, you know, you just, they wouldn't even talk to you.
So okay, you
come back later, you know.
Yeah, so you knew you had to get.
So
your
you knew
service.
You had to have your military service out of the way, and you knew, and then I mean, joining the union was no problem. You just go down with $15-$20 in your hand, and you could join the union.
Right.
But you had to be a member. And then you go over and apply. That's the way it was.
Yeah. How did
so,
you?
So I said, okay, well, you know, I'm not going to go anywhere. And the military somehow appealed to me. I don't really know how, but in all my readings and. You know, I always admired the adventures of the great heroes. You know, Kit Carson and
mm-hmm.
and I just can't kind of think of many now. But all those, they struck out and they did risk their lives, you know, and at great peril. And there was adventure and that kind of appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided rather than to go to college. Well, when I asked my dad, you know, I had that in the back of my mind. But when I asked my dad for that money, he said, "Well, I needed to get a job." That was the first thing, the most important thing. So I didn't push it anymore, you know. Said, okay, college is not in, you know, in my line, so that's why I joined the Army.
Frank, did you have any feelings about that, not being able to take up that scholarship? Or did
I regret it now, mm-hmm. looking back. But, you know, well, yeah, I could have taken it, but it would have led me in a new life. It may have led me a different way than I really went. So I don't know.
Okay.
You know, I just... It's things you look back and you say, well, but no, I didn't take it up, and I joined the Army and gave up that scholarship and worked my way up, you know, through the ranks.
Mm-hmm. What year did you graduate from high school, actually?
1961.
Okay. And what did you see before you then? You weren't going to go to college. Did you know that you had to go ahead and enter military service? And did you have any particular plans for what that service would look like?
No. I just said, okay, I got to go, you know, join the Army. No career intention. Just mm-hmm. that's something I had to get out of the way, get my check mark for before I could do anything else without the college. So I joined, and in the process, you know, I kind of simulated right in, and I kind of liked. You know, it was adventurous. I got to do things I never was able to do before.
Sure.
You know, and they were fun things. They were physical things, you know, shooting, the running, the PT. I mean, I was all part of my thing. So I was in there, and I was good at it. And kind of fell in place.
Now, Frank, did you decide particularly that you wanted to be in the Army as opposed to another branch of service?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Army kind of appealed to me more than any other service.
Was that... based on your readings, had you...
Most of it, yeah.
Uh-huh. Were you interested in, for example, the Civil War period?
Civil
or?
War, yeah, that's
okay.
been... I'm uh-huh. kind of... Not a real buff, but yeah.
But
Civil
drawn
War
to that. Uh-huh.
enthralls me, and the ordeals that, you know, the human ordeals that I've read, you know, and the anguish, and I just wonder how people lived up, and could I live up to those same kinds of standards under those conditions.
Well, do you remember...
Not that I really knew uh-huh. I was going to go to war, but, you know...
Yeah. But
kind
still,
of lifestyle appealed.
Yeah, you had that in your mind.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Did you go and talk to a recruiter, or how did you actually enlist?
Yeah, no, I I got my dad, and I said, Dad, I can't, you know, I'd been working odd jobs and stuff, like I said, for a couple of years. And I said, when I went home, I quit my job. I said, I'm tired of this. You know, all I'm getting is just part-time work here and there. You know, I'm getting money in my pocket, but I'm not going anywhere. Living in a one-room, you know, apartment house or something. And struggling from week to week just to stay alive. So I said, this is not getting me anywhere. So I said, it's time for me to do something. And so I went home, told asked Dad. My dad said, how about taking me to the Army recruiter? I said, I'm going to join the Army. And he didn't argue. You know, he did. He took me there one morning. I talked to the recruiter, set things up. And
Where was that, Frank?
In Waynesburg, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Yeah. And do you remember that recruiter at all?
No, I don't know who it was or anything.
Okay.
I mean, I went in and said, you know, I want to join the Army.
Mm-hmm.
He can go fill out the paperwork. Everything just fell in place.
And did you, what was your initial enlistment time for?
2 years.
Okay.
Well, no, it was three. I'm sorry. I volunteered. I was a volunteer, so I had a three-year obligation.
Okay.
And the draftees had 2 years. Yeah.
Right. Did you select a specialization at that time?
Yeah. I picked infantry.
Okay.
Said I want to be in a challenging field, and I said, you know, infantry. Even though I tested out for other skills, you know, because I had a good academic background
right.
in high school.
Right.
I wanted the challenge, the physical challenge, more so than anything.
So soon thereafter, I imagine you were off to basic.
Yep.
Okay.
Went from there and then down to Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Okay. Well, tell me about your basic, first of all. That began roughly when? Do you remember?
In November 1963.
Okay.
November.
And you went down to South Carolina to Fort Jackson.
Yeah.
Do you remember that trip?
Yeah, by train from Fairfield, West Virginia. I had to go down there in an induction station and did your physicals and swore you in. Then you got on the train and, you know, down through the eastern U.S. overnight on the train sometime. I don't know. I forget when we got in. It was like in the middle of the night we got in down there in Columbia, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Bust out to the base and, you know, everything was kind of confusing. It was all new challenges. You know, sergeants yelling at us.
Right.
We're standing there in the middle of the night wondering why these guys are hollering at us, you know, trying to get us organized. But
do you remember about how many guys were out there getting yelled at?
Oh, we had
you?
A couple hundred. I mean, it was a whole, like, company full.
Really?
Yeah, coming in. I mean, that train just kind of picked up guys. And
along the way?
From where we were, picked up others, and, you know, we all assembled out there in the middle of the night.
Did you get to sleep that night?
Yeah. I think eventually it got us into a bunk somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your routine at basic. How did things kind of shake out? What were you doing during the day?
Well, it was very physical. I mean, it was up in the morning, early, probably earlier than most of us ever really had to get up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, clean up, fall out for the physical training, very first order of business. And then it hit us pretty hard with PT, I remember back then.
Right. How did you do with that?
I did fine.
You were in pretty good shape.
I was in pretty good shape, so
okay.
It didn't bother me. I could do what I was always, I mean, never had any problem with that.
Uh-huh. And did you actually in some way kind of enjoy it? You
yeah.
get into it?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was, you know, we'd run and all that, and then that was no hardship at all.
Right.
And then, you know, learning the basic drills. Now, that was kind of monotonous, you know, marching left, right, falling right.
Mm-hmm.
But learning that and learning, you know, getting in step, and that was, you know, we did that. You had your basic military subjects, you know, courtesy, etiquette, ethics, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any particular instructors there?
No, I can't recall any.
Okay. Nobody sort of left an impression on you?
Uh-uh.
Okay.
Not a single one, no.
You know, you mentioned earlier about taking the oath when you were sworn in.
Uh-huh.
And I noted that you actually referred to that in the form that you filled out for us.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember taking that oath?
Yeah, you stood there, you know, you swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States and, you know, defend this country with your life. That was pretty impactful. I mean, that's a pretty strong commitment, I thought.
And you took it seriously. It wasn't just a step to go through.
No, yeah, you're right, yeah. I mean, when you're going to do this, this is a, you know, that's probably conditioned by all that I heard before, you know, that you're going to step out here and the forward edge, if called, and put your life on the line if need be. So I really got into it, you know, because I took this stuff serious. You know, the shooting, throwing a hand grenade, this was all important stuff for me.
Now, in November 1963, of course, the president was assassinated. I wonder if you remember that.
Oh, yeah, I do. I was home. I hadn't entered yet.
Okay. Oh, really?
I had seen a recruiter. I was coming in the Army. And that day, I was at the house when that announcement came on TV. I was just waiting for the recruiter to call and tell me when to report into the induction station.
Really?
So I was home.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel? Do you remember?
I don't know. It's like, well, something impacted on me. I listened with awe, just awestruck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, did this really happen? And had no idea what it was. So.
And did you?
I was ready to go, though.
Yeah, and did you pay attention to it over the next couple, 3 days?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, are we going to war? I mean, those kind
yes.
of things crossed my mind. Are
yes,
we,
I'm sure.
Are we into the big war now, or, you know, what's happening here? I mean, all that stuff was coming over the air, and it was just uncertainty, really.
And just a few days later, then you...
Then I went in, right after, all that pretty well settled down, and the recruiter called and told me, to report in down there in Fairfield, West Virginia, to the induction station.
Mm-hmm. There at Fort Jackson during basic, did you feel like you were getting, like you were sort of peering over the edge at a new possibility for yourself in terms of a career? Mm-hmm. Did you start to think about that?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I didn't mind it. You know, I didn't mind... Sergeant would get in my face when I'd make a mistake, and it was, yes, Sergeant, we'll do, you know, and I'd
right.
do it, and I'd struggle harder. It would inspire me to do better, you know, if I did something wrong, if I didn't make a... And these guys, I didn't see them as an enemy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, some guys do. They take them, oh, boy, this is awful, but, you know, I saw it as an inspiration. And as a result, I was, I was able to move up what they call the acting jack.
Mm-hmm.
They wear the armband, you know, even though I was a private.
Right.
Private nothing. I got the armband, platoon sergeant, you know, so, I mean, I moved up into student leadership type of roles.
Right away.
Because I guess I clicked.
Yeah.
And
they could see that.
And I guess they could see that, so they mm-hmm. pulled me out and made me the platoon sergeant, and I could pick up on stuff real quick.
And did that sort of kind of fuel the fire?
That kind of fueled the fire. It says, you know, hey, there, you know, this is... This must be for me because, you know, here I am. Look at this. You know, even though I didn't get any pay or anything, but I enjoyed it. And I enjoyed that being the leader, issuing the orders, trying to, you know, solve the problems and conditions. And these things weren't my textbook stuff. This is stuff where you had to, you know, play on the ground, move on the ground. And I don't know. It's more like a chess match, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you do weapons qualifying at this point?
Yeah, we did weapons qualifying. Mm-hmm.
What were you training on?
Basically, well, in basic training, it was just the individual rifle. It was the M14.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, throw a hand grenade, shoot the rifle, and that's basically it.
And did you qualify with the M14 at that point?
Oh, definitely. Uh-huh. Definitely, yeah.
Uh-huh. Had you had experience with handling guns and stuff when you were younger?
Yeah, you know, 22s, shotguns.
Uh-huh.
Shooting. I mean, I could shoot a rifle. I wasn't scared to shoot it.
Right. So you're familiar in some way.
You know, going rabbit hunting. You know, generally, though, it was just, you don't really aim. You just point and shoot. But here they were teaching accuracy, you know, hitting a target, scoring points
uh-huh.
and stuff. So, you know, it taught me a little more.
Now, when did you come out of basic, Frank?
Let's see. It was 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. So...
So sometime maybe in
November, December, probably January or so. But then I went into advanced infantry training.
Right away?
Yeah. So basic was 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then straight out of there, right at Fort Jackson, into advanced infantry training.
Okay. Tell us about that. What kinds of things did you learn?
Now, in advanced infantry training, we learn more, you know, squad maneuvers, squad tactics, more crew serve weapons, firing machine guns, mortars, you know, other kinds of weapons,
mm-hmm.
get qualified with those, you know, expanding your knowledge of infantry techniques and infantry skills, and getting qualified in all that kind of stuff. Again, I was, you know, like the acting platoon sergeant.
Mm-hmm. And were you feeling more and more comfortable, the more things they brought to you.
Right, because by then, you know, we had all that basic drill and all that, so we're kind of familiar with the courtesy part, familiar with the marching, you know, all that kind of stuff was becoming second nature.
Right, the essentials of
military. Were concentrating more on honing those kinds of skills, like shooting those machine guns, qualifying on them, which were a little more difficult to master than a standard rifle, and things like that, getting people qualified on these crew serve weapons and things, and the tactics. The tactics, I think, always fascinated me, was moving cross-country, navigating, you know, getting your people deployed, finding the objective, you know, that kind of stuff.
Did you have mock field trial kind of exercises?
Yeah, we did.
Can you describe one or
two? There were, like, patrols. They give you a mission here to move from here. You know, there's an objective. You either recon it or something like that, and report back information, that kind of stuff, without being detected. So it was like a game. It was playing, like a game playing tag in the woods.
Right.
We weren't really shooting at each other, but, you know, we were still playing a game.
Right, and there was some strategy and some thinking.
There's some strategy, and you're trying to be sneaky.
Right. And how much time were you spending in classroom as opposed to out in the field maneuvering or working with the weapons?
Let's see. I'd say... Well, there's more time out in the woods with the weapons and the tactics than there was in the classroom. But there were things in the classroom where, you know, learning about leadership, the principles, fundamentals of how you lead people, inspire people, what you can do, that kind of stuff. Most of that, I think, probably about three-fourths of the time was out in the field somewhere.
Okay. And were you making friends and kind of gelling with a group at this point?
Yes, I was. Okay. Plus, I had applied at this point for OCS. Let me think. I guess it was my company commander's suggestion. Somebody suggested it to me. You know, I don't know how I went about it, but somehow somebody said, you know, you ought to put in for OCS, so I filled an application out. And I had a board interview, all that kind of stuff while I was in AIT.
Do you remember that interview?
Yeah, I had to get all dressed up.
Had
to go in, and they asked you all kinds of weird questions. Now, one of them, and I don't know how I did on this one, they kind of asked me how I felt about girls or something, you know.
Oh, really?
And I'm wondering, what in the world, you know? How do I feel? Well, that was a tough one to answer at that point. But I can remember I stumbled on that. I don't know if I gave her a good answer. But anyhow, they recommended that I go.
And later, did you think of what the reason for that question was?
But that one question, out of all the technical questions, that one kind of... It stuck with me, and it stumbled me.
Threw you a little bit.
Threw me.
You probably weren't expecting.
I mean, you know, you can ask you know, what's range of your weapon?
Sure.
And what do you think about girls? I go, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that was kind of left field, huh?
So I don't know. They probably were just checking me out, you know, my sexuality.
Probably.
If there had to be a point, that's probably what it was.
Okay, and evidently you passed.
So I must have gave the right answer.
That's right. You handled it fine, apparently. So the board that you were interviewing with then apparently recommended that you move.
They recommended I could go to OCS.
Okay.
So I was instead I was on orders to go to Germany, you know, after graduating from advanced infantry training. So those orders were canceled on my selection for OCS, and I was put in hold status pending the next available class. Let's see, this all was like 64, and this was like in a spring or so, and I entered OCS in October 1964.
So the summer of 1964.
So that summer, I just kind of laid around up there at Fort Jackson doing much of nothing.
Okay, like daily duties?
Well, daily duties, but, you know, I maintained physical fitness, you know, me and a couple other guys. That were going to OCS, we were kind of put in a headquarters company, and we'd go run, and, you know, we just had details, we'd do this, that, whatever duties they assigned us to do.
Right. But you were just, in effect, marking time until...
Marking time, waiting for the OCS class, yeah.
And do you remember some of the guys that you were with at that point who were going on to OCS, or did they take different paths?
Yeah, one of them was my real good buddy, Ranger buddy, Bob Taft.
Okay.
He was killed in Vietnam. He died.
I think Bob was with the 1st of the 7th.
1st
of
the 7th, yeah.
And you know, we may have a chance to talk about him later.
Okay.
But you already knew him at this point?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, we were there together at Fort Jackson waiting for this class to open.
Oh, okay.
So we kind of, you know, go out at night, spend whatever money we had, and sit the rest of the month out there on a base.
And just kind of wait for time to go by?
And waiting, yeah, and, you know, running, keeping in shape.
Sure. Now, what did you know, really, about OCS before you got there? Did you have any information?
Well, yeah, I heard that it was going to be tough. There was going to be a physical challenge and a tough mental challenge. And, you know, so and we were trying to prepare ourselves. We had officers, you know, stationed at Fort Jackson who were products of OCS talk to us.
Uh-huh. That was kind of informal?
Give us, yeah, it was all informal, but it was just like, here's what's going to happen, here's the way the things work, you know.
And was that helpful to you to get...
So, yeah, so you kind of had, you know, your mind, mentally, you were able to say, okay, you know.
Did you...
have to be prepared to take a lot of this mental, you know, well, I don't know, I like to use the word demeaning, but this mental bashing, you know.
Okay, uh-huh.
And they try to... Mentally try to break you at that point, you know.
For the purpose of weeding people out?
Yeah. I guess to see if you're a strong mental character, fortitude, if you're willing to stick it out, you know, and really put some mental pressure on you.
Okay.
As well as physical.
Did you regret not getting to go to Germany, or were you looking forward to OCS?
No, I was looking forward to OCS.
Okay. So the Germany...
that was a new... Yeah, you know, that was opening up a new opportunity. So, no, not going to Germany didn't. I mean, that just, shoot.
Who cares, right?
Who cares?
Okay.
Now?
Okay. When you actually went down to Georgia, to Fort Benning,
uh-huh.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Trip? Okay. Can you tell us what you remember about it?
Yeah. All I remember is this PFC by then had the wings on my uniform, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd gone to the barbershop because, you know, they told us, get your hair cut.
Right.
So I had my hair cut. So don't come in there with long hair and all that.
Right.
And so, you know, with apprehension, but what I'm going to do, I walked up to the company, dragging my duffel bag,
mm-hmm.
signed in. Once you signed in, then that was it. I don't know. I can't remember too much after that. Because
okay.
The senior candidates then, attack officers, just got all over you, yelling at you. We were dropping for push-ups. Every time we turned around, we did something wrong. Trying to get to our room assignment, get our duffel bag up there. Everything we did was wrong.
Right.
Walk wrong, talk wrong, weren't carrying a duffel bag right. I mean, it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that was took a while to get up to the room to try to get your gear in. And then, of course, setting the gear up, you didn't follow SOP because we had no idea what the SOP was.
Right, therefore you couldn't follow.
So there was
it.
Always, you know, they were always on us.
Yeah.
Constantly. I mean, minute after minute. Till bedtime. Then, of course, after bedtime, I think it was 10 o'clock at night, it was a go to bed. You know, that was your, everything got quiet.
And you would probably just collapse.
And then, yeah, and then you're going, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You're too tired. You know, at least that first night, I don't know, how do you go to sleep in this? You know, some of you expecting somebody going to jump at you and tell you you're not sleeping, or right?
Now, did that kind of pressure with the instructors and officers sitting right on top of you and in your face all the time, did that continue?
Yeah, that's all through the first early phases of OCS, first couple of weeks. It's called, I guess they call it hazing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty rough.
Yeah. And how did you do with it?
Right. Well, I did fine. I mean, you know, under your breath, you might have said some nasty things, but
mm-hmm.
you held your tongue because many others, you know, would break and just, you know, have enough of it.
And did some people...
Yeah, I can't recall her name, but yeah, some people mm-hmm. flat said that I'm not going to, you know, this...
Not worth it, or...
Not worth it, yeah.
Yeah. How long were you actually at Fort Benning for the OCS training?
23 weeks.
23 weeks?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so well into early
1965. So October, so we got graduated in April 1965.
Okay. Now, in there, did you... were you giving any thought to... American policy at that time?
No. All we were given thought to was leading troops in combat.
Okay.
How to, you know, then what our role as a young officer is to lead by example. So we had to be honed in our weapon skills, you know. And of course, as an officer now, we had to qualify. We had to know all the weapons, you know, machine guns, grenade launchers, the bazookas, the mortars. We had to know all of those things, how they worked and everything, to know how to employ them and all, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
now our knowledge and everything couldn't be just focused on just one weapon or something like that. It had to be everything across the board.
And did you also have to know not only how to deploy them in the field,
right,
and how to operate them, but also, for example, how to take care of them?
How to take care of them.
Uh-huh.
You know, what we talked about leadership, which is, you know, welfare of your troops, accomplishment of the mission, and combine those two aspects.
Uh-huh.
And how do you do it, you know? And there was that was the big focus. The idea was, you know, take them and bring them back alive.
Right. And do whatever it takes, really, in there to get the mission
done.
Yeah,
you know, employ, use the weapons, use the artillery, you know, all this stuff. Yeah.
And go ahead.
To you know, destroy the enemy position or whatever it was occupying, you know, and bring your people back out alive.
How exactly did they train you to assume command and assume leadership?
Well, you had student leadership positions, and they put you into, you know, canned scenarios and saw how you reacted.
Okay.
What your concerns were. They evaluated how well you could plan and think, how well you issued orders and communicated to the subordinate elements, how well you know.
So again, you had sort of mock setups that you would go through.
Uh huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many were in your class?
Oh, I can't think. In the OCS, we had quite a few. Probably had about 180 people.
Okay. And did the OCS classes only form just so many times a year? Is that why?
And then I think we only had like four classes in session at one time. That was prior Vietnam War.
Yes. Uh huh.
So it hadn't built up.
It hadn't accelerated it to that point.
At that point, even in OCS, we knew there was a war going on, but it was a strictly guerrilla war, advisory kind of war. American troops had not been committed.
Right.
I don't think anybody would. If anybody was thinking about it, it wasn't down at our level. It might have been at high levels. But our training and all was just conventional, you know, general war against the big Axis bloc or whatever.
Okay, so you're really thinking about
we were
general
thinking about Soviet Union,
European,
and Europe. In Europe, the big war in Europe.
Right. I should ask you this now. At what point did you actually go to Ranger School?
Okay. Right after OCS.
Okay.
Graduated from OCS and entered Ranger School.
Now, how did it come about that you were selected for the Rangers?
We applied, and, you know, on our chain of command, OCS recommended us. So upon commissioning, you know, our orders took us right over to Ranger School.
Now, how many guys went over there?
There were quite a few. Maybe about one fourth of our class went from OCS into Ranger School.
Did Bob Taft go with you?
He was my Ranger buddy.
Okay.
He and I, what we call Ranger buddies, they teamed us up together, and we were to take care of each other in Ranger School. And this was another aspect. Now, we were commissioned by Dan. Now, Ranger training really gets into the difficult part of the infantry.
Yes, sir.
You know, where we normally go walk cross country and all that. This stuff was, you know, water operations, operating behind enemy lines in small units. You know, you don't have everybody on your right and left. You're pretty well self-sustaining here.
Where did this training take place?
It took place in three locations. For phase one at Fort Benning.
Uh-huh.
And we spent, about 3 weeks there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved north into North Georgia, Dahlonega. And we did mountain techniques up there.
Oh, really?
Mountain climbing, working in those mountains and everything.
Uh-huh. Isn't that where the gold strike was?
Yeah.
Up
through those hills.
Right.
And
those are some serious mountains too.
Yeah, there were. And we learned, you know, how to do the climbing, tying in, using the pitons, do actual mountain climbing stuff in it.
Okay.
Uh-huh. To be able to operate in that kind of terrain. And then in the final 3 weeks in Florida, in the swamps, simulating, you know, jungles and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And there we learned water survival skills and working in and around the waterways and all that.
I think it's generally known as, you know, incredibly physically demanding.
Very. They stress you not only, you know, moving it. It's not so much peak physical training. It's each of those phases is actual patrolling operations out in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
You have a mission. It's a simulated enemy country, and you're behind enemy lines. You're not working, you know, in conjunction with other troops on your right and left. So you have to constantly be alert at all times, maintaining security. You're a small group. You want to be undetected. And you live on minimum rations. You try to sustain yourself from the local, you know, whatever land they have to offer, or friendly partisans, if there were, in fact, any friendly partisans around, which, you know, people friendly to your cause.
Right.
And try to sustain yourself through that. And so that meant going long periods of time without eating. Yeah, you got very hungry. That's one of the things you did do in that thing.
Yeah.
And you learn how to continue to operate, and you operate at night without sleep.
And some people don't make it through this also.
Absolutely. They broke down physically, and some people broke down mentally because of the lack of sleep.
Lack of sleep.
We just break them.
Frank, how do you think you managed to make it through? What was it that was driving you to complete this successfully?
Just pure determination.
Okay.
People like the friends like Bob, you know, we're encouraging each other. I mean, there are times we'd get discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd be at the point where I don't think I can make this anymore. And they'd say, oh, come on, you know, call you. You know, and you help each other.
Right.
And pull each other along.
Now, were there, Bob was your sort of your training buddy, you said?
Yeah, we call him Ranger Buddy. Yeah.
Ranger Buddy, okay. And were there other guys, too, who were important to you and whom you were important to in this time period?
Well, yeah, there were a lot of friendships. A lot of us knew each other because we were, you know, we graduated and gone through OCS together.
Right.
And then we were in the Ranger class. Joe Marm was another one.
Uh-huh.
And he went through Ranger class, I'm trying to think. So we had, you know, these were friendships. We were friends with each other.
Now,
And this kind of thing, you know, and when we get down, and we knew each other, so we could confide in each other.
Yeah.
And that helped.
Yeah. So you didn't have to be like Superman around.
No, you didn't have to be like that. You could tell these guys, you know, I'm
fed up
with this, and they say, well, you know, one more day, you know, you can make it one more day, or
something,
you know, give you some kind of encouragement.
Right, exactly. And was that really, would you say, crucial to getting through this?
Yeah, I think it is
essential.
Pretty vital.
Uh-huh.
If you have a partner, have a buddy or somebody to do that when you really get going down.
I think in the forms you filled out, you also mentioned that pride had something to do with it, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Can you talk about that for a sec?
Well, you know, I guess it's up to you being able to, you know, accomplish things that you thought maybe never were able to. And to being treading the same ground where others have gone before you, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to prove, well, you know, you're proving to yourself more or less, but saying, you know, I'm as good as they are. You know, I'm up to the challenge. You know, and that makes you feel good.
Now, can you describe, for example, what your time down in Florida was like? Where were you? Do you know?
Eglin Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
Then it didn't matter. You're swampy. You're always wet, miserable. you know, it was dark during the day. It was probably so hot.
Yeah.
But beating around through the thick brush at night, swamp in the water, and trying to be quiet as you can without making much noise.
Uh-huh.
Locate the target or the enemy position, the objective you were assigned. Attack it, destroy it, catch them by surprise.
And then,
as a small unit, you know, you had to get back out of there real quick, so you had to learn, you know, learn your extraction by foot or by, you know, boat, or how are you going to be extracted.
And did you have, for example, simulations of injuries so that you would have to be responsible for getting?
Oh, yeah. They would, every once in a while, you know, the cadre would say, okay, you've got 3 casualties, and he'd designate somebody, so you'd have to, you know, carry an ammo on your back or carry an ammo and transport them.
Was there any kind of a ceremony or anything when you were done with the training, when you had actually successfully completed it?
We had a graduation ceremony.
Where was that?
Fort Benning.
Okay.
At the big infantry school.
Okay.
We went in there, dressed up in our khakis, and we all got our Ranger tabs, you know, in a formal ceremony.
Okay. And how did you feel when that was happening?
Yeah, you feel proud. You felt, you know, I've really gone through something tough, and I'm able, you know, I succeeded.
And what would
that's
what,
a challenge.
What would your rank have been at this point, Frank?
I was a second lieutenant.
Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, I'd just gotten commissioned, so
right.
I was still a second lieutenant.
Okay.
Hadn't been to a unit yet, but...
But that was coming pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, we knew it was coming. While we were in Ranger School, we got orders to the 1st Cav Division.
Okay.
So while we were in Ranger School, in the Florida phase, they came in one day. We was there eating lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And Kadri came in and said, okay, following change in orders have been announced. And we didn't know anything about going to Vietnam at this point.
Okay.
But all our orders got changed. Like, I was on orders to 101st Airborne Division in Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And others were different units. While they came in, said all the following orders, and they read our name off, and it was practically our whole class.
Really?
And I was assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division, Fort Benning, Georgia. I'm going, wow, what's going on?
You know? Something's happened.
And so then mm-hmm. we started talking, and other people said, well, we heard this, we heard that. And finally we connected and said, uh-oh. Then it didn't tell us we were going to Vietnam, but we kind of figured it out. That was it.
And was your
and it wasn't long after that that President Johnson appeared on TV and made that announcement. He's ordered the 1st Cav Division to Vietnam.
Right. So about what time would this have been?
This is July mm-hmm. of 1965, mm-hmm. somewhere here.
And you just mentioned that you thought, uh-oh, when you sort of found out that you were 1st Cav and...
Yeah. Why? You know, why the change? All, you know, well, we knew that we could sense something was amiss. When they come in, they change everybody's orders.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's now reassigned to 1st Cav Division. We go, what is this about, you know?
Yeah. And you said that you guys kind of worked it out on your own.
Oh, yeah. We kind of just talking to each other and others hearing this, hearing that, and said, okay, you know, we're going to be going into combat.
Do you remember President Johnson's speech?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you actually watch it?
Yeah.
It was happening?
Yeah, and live. And mm-hmm. So they had confirmed everything. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe, if you remember, what your thinking was at that time?
Well, you know, I just thought we'd entered a new threshold of life, that this is what all we've been training for.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in these last year or so that I've been in the Army, this was it. We were going to be put to the test.
Frank, what did you know about Vietnam, if anything, at that point?
Nothing.
Just, was there any chatter amongst the guys about what it must be like, or was it just kind of a vacuum?
It was kind of a vacuum at that point. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we had no idea what, you know, Vietnam was real low on our radar map. We knew there was something going on over there, but, you know, anybody that went was strictly advisory, guerrilla-type war.
Mm-hmm.
Not what we were right. mentally all keyed up for.
Right.
But now suddenly it was taken, you know, now we wanted to know what is Vietnam? What's it all about? What is going on?
So you stayed then at Fort Benning for a little while?
Well, we joined the Cav Division that reformed, you know, he pulled the colors back from Korea.
Yes.
The division at uh-huh. Fort Benning in the Army Church area. And so after we graduated from Ranger School, you know, we all went out and checked in, got assigned to our units, our various units.
Mm-hmm.
Bob and I got split up at that point. He went to the 1st to the 7th Cav,
mm-hmm.
and I went to the 1st to the 8th. In the same division, but different battalions.
Different battalions, uh-huh.
Yeah.
When you say that the colors were pulled back from Korea, for someone who didn't understand that, could you say what that means?
Well, what they mean is they took the Cavalry Division, you know, the national, the colors, the standards for the division.
Yes.
And... reactivated the 2nd Infantry Division, which is currently stationed in Korea. And so they brought the colors, which is the division standard,
mm-hmm.
back to Fort Benning and reorganized what they call reorganized the 1st Cavalry Division, Air Mobile. And they made it an Air Mobile Division.
Did you know, really, I suppose with Ranger training you had an idea, but what Air Mobile tactics really were?
No. The 11th Air Assault Division guys mostly did that.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But being Ranger, we weren't too familiar with air mobile operations, other than we had conducted some raids using helicopters
okay.
in Ranger School.
But you didn't really sort of put it together with this kind of new operational
tag. No, so what we had to do was, as we got in a division, was kind of train and learn as a new member of division. Now, there were old 11th Air Assault people already around that had practiced and trained under that 11th Air Assault test concept.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of familiar on how to do all this. So it was kind of new for me and Bob and all the rest of us.
Sure.
But it wasn't too hard for us to catch on.
Okay.
I mean, it haven't been what we've been through and trained, so
yeah.
It was just a new way of getting to the job, you know, getting to this where you need to go.
Do you remember any of the guys who were introducing the concept, and how exactly was it introduced to you?
It was kind of just been in our units, like, pretty rapid, because, I mean, here you are in your unit and say, okay, here we're going, you know. And if you didn't know what to do, you had to ask somebody, hey, what am I supposed to do? And they said, well, just wait in the helicopter, get on it, and go.
Okay. So it was
kind of
kind of
rough. It was kind of like, you know, learn as you go type of thing.
Right, you had to pick it up.
Pick it up.
Okay. At what point did you actually receive orders that you knew the one of the eighth was going to be deployed overseas?
When I got to the division, when President Johnson made the announcement.
Okay.
That was it. We knew then for sure.
Okay.
You know, because he said, and until then, nobody said nothing official.
Uh-huh.
Although we all suspected, you know.
Right, okay.
Uh-huh. And then when he came on TV and said, I have now ordered the 1st Cavalry Division of Vietnam, bingo. Said, okay. So that put us, you know, we notched it up another gear.
Now, did you...
As far as our intensity, mental intensity and
sure.
all that.
Yeah.
We notched it up.
Right, because now you're pointed in the direction that you're going to go.
Yeah, now we knew for sure.
Okay.
There's no doubt about it.
Now, at what point did you actually group to embark for overseas?
Okay. At what point? It was there at Fort Benning.
Yes.
We filled our units, NCOs, cadre, enlisted. Got our companies filled, our platoons filled. What we call POR, qualified them, shots, get their shot records. Everybody qualified on their weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Made sure everything was working, packed up everything, set out. The big thing I remember, we had the old white T-shirts and the old white name tags and everything, and said, well, we're going in, so we dyed everything green, including our underwear and towels.
Really?
And the big story was there in Columbus, Georgia, we ordered, everybody to take green dye and dye all their white stuff, so people were going in laundromats in town.
Mm-hmm.
And soldiers had been in there and used the green dye in his washing machines.
Uh-huh.
So other civilians and families would go in those laundromats with their white clothes while a lot of that dye was still left. And their whites would get dyed green.
They were all getting fatigue wear as well.
Yeah, because we'd done that, and I remember that was a big stink.
Yeah, I bet it was. So you guys had to actually do your own dyeing?
Yeah, take all our white T-shirts, undershorts, on our white towels and stuff, and dye them green.
That's interesting. At some point, then you got ready to actually go overseas,
uh-huh.
And I gather you were going to go by ship. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. How did that come about?
Okay, we formed. When we got our movement orders at Fort Benning, we assembled sometime in the middle of the night. I can't remember, but it was late.
Okay.
They got all their troops assembled, and commercial buses came in, and we were dispatched under platoon control. That was, I was a platoon leader, second lieutenant. So
right.
I had one bus assigned to me, and all my troops would be on that bus. My platoon was about 43 members.
Mm-hmm.
And we were given directions to go to Savannah, Georgia, told not to check in until about, this was maybe 2 or 3 in the morning. We loaded the bus and departed Fort Benning. And then on our own, we made our way across Georgia to Savannah. We were told not to get there till maybe, 5 o'clock in the evening or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because we wouldn't be able to board the ship until then. So we were on our own. The bus was under my control. And, we stopped here and there and had some hamburgers and stuff. Trying to time our arrival there so we wouldn't get there early.
Okay. Uh-huh. Do you remember?
In the Savannah Harbor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, Frank, if you remembered some of those, if you remembered stopping and getting something to eat.
Yeah, we stopped in some small town. It was like we'd been driving for a while, and
yep.
Troops were getting hungry, and we didn't want to move too fast, so we all had to make a bathroom break and everything. So.
Sure.
I remember telling the bus driver to go ahead and pull into a hamburger place. I can't remember. It was just whatever we saw along the road. I can't remember what it was or anything. And troops got out and ate hamburgers, drank Cokes, went to the bathroom. And we kind of laid around here an hour. And when we went to get back on, we had one soldier missing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we took our head count, and one of our squad leaders reported one soldier missing.
What happened with that?
He didn't get back on the bus. So we had to... got off the bus again. You know, we figured out who it was, got him by name and everything.
Yep.
I said, what's going on? So got back off the bus, talked with my NCOs. Two of my NCOs said, just for me, just stay here. And they would go check with the local police.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, and they put a lookout, and one of our guys had attempted to go AWOL. He was caught hitchhiking.
Oh, no, hitchhiking. Oh, no.
He broke away from everybody, went out down the road, and he was trying to beat feet, you know.
Yeah, right. And so, what happened to him?
Well, no, we took him, you know, we nothing.
You
we
just,
didn't do anything.
You just
we got
him
back, mm-hmm. and we said, we'll watch him. You know, the sergeant said, don't worry, we'll take care of it. So we didn't do anything to him.
Did you find out what was going on with him later on?
The more I found out, I remember, I can't remember his name exactly, but he got killed later in Vietnam, I remember.
Uh-huh.
But he was stubborn. He was from Russia. He was an immigrant.
Okay.
His family background was pretty skeptical. He was like an only child. He didn't have much family or anything here. And he had joined the Army and, you know, was just trying to serve. But I guess he didn't want to go to war. And he was a stubborn case. He caused his NCOs a lot of trouble because he was always an independent kind of guy.
Okay.
And, he just wasn't a team member, you know.
Right. And as time went on, that kind of became clear.
And it came clear. And, he died by accident. Being, you know, stubborn as he was, I remember he was loading helicopters one day to get lifted off. And his squad leader told him to carry some ammo, some extra stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he got upset about it. The sergeant yelled at him, told him, pick it up and carry the ammo, you know, got in his face. So he grabbed the ammo cans, you know, hunched his shoulders down, stuck his head down, and he walked right into the tail rotor of one of the helicopters.
Oh.
And that's how, you know, and when they explained how he got killed, what happened. So it wasn't really in combat. It was just his attitude that did it, you know.
Wow. Okay, so you were going to go back, you were going to... be moving the buses on. Now you've got the, you know, would-be AOL guys back on the bus. And
yeah, we got him back together, had everybody together again, so we just moved on to Savannah, to the harbor. Got there about, I think it was prescribed time, 4 or 5 o'clock or something like that.
Uh-huh. What happened? 20 days?
Well, there was just a big, long line of guys still there on the pier side, you know, boarding the ship. Of course, we were carrying our duffel bags, everything we had, you know, all our military gear.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got off the buses and found our place in the line and just moved on board the ship, as, you know, got our names checked off on the manifest,
mm-hmm.
and got on the ship there in Savannah and waited for everybody else to load. Officers got to go up into ward rooms.
Okay.
Got about 4 of us per room, and the enlisted men had to go down in the hold, you know, where they stack them down there like cordwood.
Sure. What was the name of the ship, do you recall?
USNS Geiger.
Okay. And at this point, Frank, did your family know what was going on with
No.
you?
No, I hadn't talked to them. We weren't allowed to tell anybody.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we were told not to say anything, you know, by phone or anything like that. My family was up in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I hadn't told them.
Okay. Had you been writing back and forth to them while
No,
you were...
No, I was busy. I was... trying to get troops. There's so much stuff I had to do. I mean, I was working from early morning till late at night, trying to get troops, you know, all the last minute stuff taken care of for deployment.
Right. And at this point, you're fully responsible for
right.
over 40 men.
Yeah. So I didn't do much writing. Yeah. I was
okay.
trying to get all that done. By the time, you know, evening would roll around, I'd be tired. I'd go home, go to bed, and get early the next morning, back at it again. Then on the ship, we didn't have any communication off the ship, but then we could write, though. So there was a lot of free time on the ship.
Okay. Now, you left out of Savannah. Uh-huh. And what was your route? Do you know?
Yeah, we went south through the canal zone, Panama mm-hmm. Canal Zone,
mm-hmm.
and come around out into the Pacific. And we made a stop in Hawaii there at Pearl Harbor. We got to get off the boat there, and that's when I called my parents.
Tell me about going through the canal. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Okay. Had you ever been?
No. This was all new. This was all a new experience. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So you know, we're just all hanging over the sides of the rails of the boat, and looking and enjoying the scenery. It wasn't too much to see, but it was an experience.
Sure.
It took about 8 hours or so to get through the canal.
That's right. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
And so then you went out. A lot of time passes, I presume, and you
got out
to,
in the Pacific, and then days or maybe a week or two passed.
And you got out to Pearl.
We pulled into Pearl Harbor, uh-huh. and we got a shore liberty, like about 8 hours or something, just to get off and head back.
So what did you do?
Huh? Well, I went to a bar, started drinking, had big dinner.
Okay, what did you have for dinner, do you know?
Probably steak or something.
Okay.
And I went to, let's see. Well, I was with the battalion commander, so, you know, most of us officers, I think we went to an officers club there somewhere and had a big dinner, mm-hmm. you know, just standing around the bar drinking Mai Tais, I remember.
Oh, really?
Yeah, first time we ever had those with fresh pineapple. Uh-huh. Oh, I can remember how good that was.
Were you with primarily now the battalion commanders at this point?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And were you seeing or were there on the ship other battalions besides your...
Yeah, there were three other battalions, or two others. There were three of us, three battalions together.
Okay, do you know the numbers of the other guys that went on the
ship? The 2nd of the 8th and the 2nd of the 12th.
Okay.
Infantry, yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about the commanders that you were with? Who did you report to, for example?
I reported Colonel Kenneth Mertel.
How do you spell his last name?
Mertel.
Okay. And... He has written a book, has he not?
He wrote a book. What's the name of that book?
A year. What was it?
The Year of the Horse.
Yes,
okay,
that's right.
I remember that. Yeah.
Okay.
That kind of pretty well outlines, you know, our whole battalion's movement and everything.
Right. What kind of a guy was he? How did he impress you?
He impressed me as pretty, erect, straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
He was a gung ho. Go get him kind of guy.
Did you feel confidence in the guys that you
were reporting to? Yeah, I could feel confidence in him in the way, in his mannerisms. He was out there running with us. I mean, it wasn't just issuing orders, but he was there with us, you know, inspiring us through personal example. And,
really? Okay.
And things. So, you know, he really, when you see him coming around, you wanted to show him that you were, you know, as good as he was, if not better.
right. So he was kind of inspiring you to
So he was inspiring us,
improve.
Yeah.
Improve, okay.
Sure was.
And that's pretty important, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
in terms
it is.
Of how you're adjusting.
You build like this camaraderie, this family, because, you know, this is your family.
Right.
And, you know, there's nowhere else to go right now. You know?
Sure, that's right.
I mean, no matter how good or bad you feel, this is it, you know. These guys all around you are guys you live with, sleep with, eat with.
And would you say that at this point, you and others were looking for the best in each other rather than kind of looking for faults or shortcomings? Were you guys
absolutely trying to, you know, to get along. I mean, you're living side by side, day in, day out, and you know, your lives depend on each other.
Right.
And you got to be able to count on each other.
And you felt that already even at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we kind of, you build this camaraderie.
Now
and
you,
if, you know, somebody doesn't fit in, like, you know, there were times that we had some that didn't fit in, and, they, you know, you kind of push them out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you call it, yeah.
Frank, you said that you called your folks from Pearl.
From Hawaii. That was first I talked to them.
How'd that go?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
They thought that something was happening, because they hadn't heard from me in a couple weeks.
Right, so they had an inkling.
And they thought, well, yeah. And then I called them from there and told them.
Uh-huh.
That I'm on my way.
And
because then we were underway, so I guess, I don't know if we were allowed to or not. I just told them I was. That's the first time I told them.
Uh-huh. And they were supportive, would you say?
Well, yeah, it was just like, okay, yeah, you know, what can we do about it? Right. There's nothing that can be done yet.
Right. Yep. Concerned?
Yeah, they were concerned.
Okay. Tell me about the rest of your trip over. Did you stop again after Hawaii?
Yeah, we moved on. You know, on board the ship, it was just pretty monotonous. We had
sure.
PT on deck every day, and we would have just sit around discussions about tactics and stuff with our NCOs, and there wasn't too much else to do.
Was it incredibly crowded on the ship?
Oh, very crowded. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, with the troops and everything, it was really crowded. So things, well, you couldn't move too much. Of course, we'd rotate units to the deck.
Right.
Throughout the day, and then just do PT on deck was what the fun thing. That was the funnest part. You know?
Yeah.
Because the rest of the time, we're just sitting around talking or just laying around, not even doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. Would you say you're getting a little bit, like, you know, bored or antsy?
Oh, yeah.
To get on with it?
Over the side, you know. Slice a little movement of water create great interest, you know.
Right.
It's something different.
Right. About how long did this whole crossing take from Savannah all the way out?
Almost a month.
Really?
About 30 days on that ship. But we did make another stop in Guam.
Okay.
Now, here we weren't given, like, shore liberty. We left the boat as a unit, performed formation, went to a beach. We had a cookout, drank some beer, back to the ship, you know,
uh-huh.
in our PT outfits, which were shorts and T-shirt.
Right.
You know, back on in just a matter of maybe 2 or 3 hours.
Do you remember that beach party, quote unquote?
Yeah. It was like, you know, go to the beach. We had beer, and they got grills out and cooked hamburgers. And
did you go swimming at all?
I got to swim, yeah,
uh-huh.
in the water.
Right.
Splash around.
You know,
uh-huh. And drink some beer, and then
right.
warm back up and get back on the ship.
Did you have seasickness at all?
No, I don't. I don't think I ever did get seasick.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's amazing.
I mean, the guys all were playing games with each other, you know,
I'm
like,
sure.
Ralph. Trying to get each other to, you
uh-huh.
know. And sometimes it worked, you know.
I believe
Some
you.
Some guys would get sick.
I believe you.
Now, down in the hold was different. Those troops down there were living, you know, all clustered together in mass. And, I mean, the smell, because all the body heat, body odor, temperature down there wasn't as cool as it was up in the wardroom where we officers were.
Was the Geiger really a troop ship? Or?
It's a troop ship, yeah. I mean, these are like big open bays, and cots were like four high.
About how old was it?
Probably a World War II
was it?
Ship, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But down there, these are big open like bays,
uh-huh.
and the temperatures were up down there. They weren't cool as
oh.
like up in the wardrooms. With all those people packed in there, plus all that body heat would add to it, the smell, and the ship moving, at least we're up topside where, you know, we could have a reference with the horizon, look outside. These guys couldn't
yeah.
see out. They're all enclosed down there, and the ship's rocking a little bit, so some of those guys would get sick.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
And all it would take would be one to get sick down there, and that odor would permeate through there, and whole bunches of them would get sick. So it was a different story down there for the enlisted.
Yeah, that's pretty tough, and to do that for a month is
yeah. Now,
amazing.
We'd go down there and just inspect them every now and then, you know.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't like we had to live down there, and that was tougher for them.
Yeah, sure was. Sir, do you remember arriving actually at Vietnam?
Yep.
Where did you come in?
Offshore at Quy Nhon Harbor.
Okay. And how did you get from the Geiger to land?
Okay, we had to go over the side on a series of steps that went down into a landing craft.
Okay.
And walked down those steps. You know, water was bobbing. I mean, it was not like a amphibious invasion, but it was kind of rough getting all your gear down, you know, carrying a duffel bag plus all your combat gear
uh-huh.
and weapons.
And making it down
get down the ladder. There was a lot of stuff went flying down there, smacking people. A lot of stuff was dropped.
Now, did you guys go in by company, or how were you?
Yeah, we went in by unit, by
okay.
company,
uh-huh.
and platoon on the landing craft, and it just rolled up on the beach, dropped the front ramp. Of course, the beach was secure. I mean,
sure.
we didn't have any ammo, so
right.
thank goodness the beach was secure. Yeah.
Right.
But we didn't get our ammo till we got on shore. Then, then we issued the ammunition.
Okay, when you actually get to the shore with your men, what were the first things that happened? Were you directed to wait or go to a certain place?
No, there were people there directing us, said, okay, what unit are you with, you know, and moving us into marshaling areas, what they call.
Okay.
So they said, you're with C Company, 1st of the 8th, over here, you know, and you'd march over there and form up with your company.
Do you know what day you actually arrived there, sir?
No. It was, I guess, August, July, August. The end of August, I know.
Okay.
Somewhere. So, it was pretty hot.
So probably sometime in August, 1965.
Yeah.
After the sort of marshaling areas that sorted themselves out, were you finally issued with ammunition? Or
yeah, we were issued our ammunition there, rations, you know, other things that we needed.
Okay.
And we had safety instructions. You know, we didn't want everybody locking and loading and all that kind of stuff, but we got magazines loaded.
And
you hear noise? Maybe my battery might be getting weak here.